All right. So in the year 3043, that's the next time we'll have a solar eclipse that lasts as long as the one we just had. Saw that in the news tonight. I'm pretty sure I won't be around for that in 3043, but you never know. You know, advancements in life-saving technologies and life-extending medicine, I could luck out. Doesn't look good, though. I mean, not for me, but maybe for future generations. That's where Joel Barker comes into this too. Always looking ahead. We'll talk about his predictions for the year 2020 coming up, and he'll go out on a limb, just like the writers did back in the year 2000 in New York Times Magazine, when they published a piece, a catalog of the near future, things we could expect, things that we could pretty much be guaranteed would be happening. By the year 2010, we'll go through the ones that they thought for sure that we would have that would be commonplace. And we'll see which ones are here, which ones are close, which ones we may not see for a long time. And then we'll take your calls too coming up. As Joel Barker also will tell us a little bit about some of the cash producing technologies, the economy expanding innovations that will. Help us all in the near future and hopefully get us back on track too. Coming up tonight on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. Well, Joel Barker, your hometown today had about 35 degrees. We were at about 35 degrees here today.
Well, where I am at, it's 70, so I like the difference.
I knew you would. And just to follow up a personal note, I tried that hamburger that you like at Salute about a week after you and I ate there. That is good. You are right. That's like the best hamburger in the world. That's pretty
It's
good.
great.
Joel Barker, as a independent scholar and futurist, somebody who watches trends and is always following innovation as it's happening in real time. Joel is as well known for being a speaker on DVDs and videos and in person as he is an author. Your latest vi video that's out, Joel, is that the book about wealth on the cutting edge or wealth
No,
innovation?
the latest video is Innovation at the Verge.
Okay, that's at the Verge. Okay.
Yeah, and that's it's the explanation of the new territory for finding innovations.
Hard for me to keep up with all of your projects. You're in town for a while, and then you're off to a for a global jaunt, or you just came back from a global jaunt?
Oh, I'm not going global until next fall now. But
Okay.
I'm gonna be in Southeast Asia for a week or 10 days in September.
Be careful as you're flying. There's
Yeah.
and I'd love to talk more about, too, by the way, the future of security innovation with you later on, but let's first go back. The conversation, as I mentioned last hour, was started about a year ago, right about like a year ago this week when we got together, and you passed along to me a copy of a New York Times Magazine piece that predicted what our life would be like in the year 2010, and you had saved it all the way since the year 2000. So we were reading through it then, and then promised to reconvene on the subject when we actually got to 2010. And it's interesting how much of it turned into science fiction, a kind of a hope for the future more than a guarantee that for sure our life would be a certain way just 10 years after the writers predicted it.
And the other thing I think, Ian, that I find so interesting is they hit it in some ways, kind of tangentially sometimes.
Right.
But they got close in surprising fashion.
Well, let's run through them, and I look forward to going through these. Some will take more time with than others, and then I want to hear more about what you predict for the future, and then we'll get to your calls. And I know everybody's very excited about this because you present a vision for the future that that is not as bleak and as dark, especially business-wise, as some people would like us to believe, that our best days are behind us and that there's no more innovation and there's no new products and we're pretty much stuck with a dwindling economy from this point forward.
Yeah, I think that's an incorrect perception of the future.
The teddy bear that knows your name was one of the ones they mentioned in this New York Times piece back in the year 2000, and there were some. There were some close, you know, there's some things that teddy bears and children's toys obviously have had a lot of innovation. Would you say this was a hit on the part of the New York Times writers?
I would say it was close because, especially in Japan, if we take a look at the work they've done, where really the last 2 years they've had very high-level, smart little robots that could, in a sense, recognize you, not know you exactly, but know that somebody was in the room and be responsive and make cooing sounds, proper sounds. The Japanese actually have done a nice job in getting the equivalent of the teddy bear robot. So I think whoever thought of that one at the New York Times was pretty close.
It's not quite as it's presented, the teddy bear robot, as we would have seen in the movie Artificial Intelligence, AI.
No.
But it, you know, Teddy Ruxpin and a couple other toys seem to get kind of close to that, although not nearly perhaps as three-dimensional as was originally predicted. But that could happen.
Yeah, and I think the other thing that they were hinting at was this would be pretty smart. And the teddy bear robots right now are pretty clever, and there's a big difference between the two.
But it is important to point out, for example, the Japanese have a market for this, much in the same way that they've been developing these robots that can take care of seniors with a human interface, maybe even a human face, that will be there to take care of the elderly, because the Japanese don't like to bring in outsiders into their culture to take care of their seniors.
Yeah. And I think even the little animals are aimed in some ways at the seniors to be a pet that might remind them of taking their medicine or speak to them about things that they remember that are important. So they are at all levels, both the full-sized robot where that's really physically helping them, but then this is an emotional robot that helps them, kind of stay in contact.
In this way, it's market-driven, not ideologically driven. It's not like somebody sitting around going, or maybe better phrased, idealistically, where somebody's saying, oh, you know, it would be ideal as if we all had robots. There seems to be a need for this in Japan that's driving the innovation.
I think that's true. And then I think there's one other kind of hidden observation we should make, which is the toy industry is starting to drive other industries because of the clever things they're doing. And so we need to watch the toy industry in particular, because they have early indicators of things that could become more important for society in general.
Early adapters. The number two thing, unless you had more on that, I want to go to the lawn that never needs mowing. This was again from the New York Times magazine piece in the year 2000, saying that by then we could all have the lawn that never needs mowing. And this is a hit.
It is, absolutely, because I've got no mow grass in my front yard of my new house. And it works.
That.
It really works.
And you have to give it a trim, once a year?
Well, actually, the guy who – we have some other things that have to be mowed because it's a different kind of grass. But in the front – he goes around once a month and just neatens it up like you would a beard, in a sense, you know. But it's not – it really hasn't grown much. It's just that he likes the lines and the – in the lawn, you know, it looks better because it's got lines in it.
Now, has it caught on? I mean, are you seeing this being employed in places all over the world yet?
Not yet, but I have heard that it's being used by highway crews, so they don't have to mow.
Oh, sure.
And that's a very energy efficient idea.
And does it require more water than a normal lawn? Does it?
Because it's not growing. You know, so, once it gets to a certain height, it stabilizes. So it actually uses less nutrients and less water.
Okay. And this is important, because then there are some communities that want to ban, you know, watering the lawn. They want to ban, they want more people to have like gravel front yards and other stuff. And this would be a compromise that if they had this, everybody could have green grass. And they could have that look, but it wouldn't require anywhere near the amount of water.
Right, and also get some CO2 processed and some oxygen.
The number three thing that was written about back in the year 2000 was makeup that changes your identity. Talk about that.
Yeah, we need a woman to talk to us about that. Because I haven't seen anything advertised on it, but I don't read enough women's magazines to know if, in fact, there's kind of a secret move on this thing that's going on and we men don't know about it.
But what was the product supposed to do?
I couldn't get it. You know, when I read the description, it sounded like color change, but then it sounded like mood change, and it sounded like you know, some of the tanning things that we've done, where you can put on a chemical and tan, but it sounded a lot more sophisticated than that. So maybe we've got it, the paint, the tanning paint that they're putting on, you know, that colors the skin.
Right.
Maybe that's what they were going after.
In the New York Times piece describing what we would have in the year 2010, Dr. James Nordlund, an expert on the human pigmentary system, offers this explanation. People are weird, and he thinks we haven't yet begun to plumb the depths of our strange desires. Wait 10 or 15 years, he says, when we might walk up into the drugstore, buy a cream that's able to flip our pigmenting mechanism on or off, and get as dark or as light as we want, that we put it on and go darker, take it off and go lighter. This coming skin tone revolution can arguably be traced back to events transpiring back in the bathroom of ranch-style homeowner Mac Hadley in 1984, and they go on to talk about this idea of, you know, the inside-out tan, taking a pill that makes you tan from the inside. It's let's just put that under the mist category. If it exists, it's hardly ubiquitous. If it exists somewhere in a lab, it's not out of the market.
Yep, we haven't seen it on QVC yet.
No. Yeah. Okay, the car that won't crash. This was a prediction, and I think we'd have to, well, ironically, we'd have to put the car that won't crash in the hit category, don't we?
Yes. That's right, because we actually have several cars with radar systems, Lexus, Mercedes, I think Volvo, has played with it, and adaptive braking, you know, so that your speed is controlled and your cruise control is all radar connected. So even though, in a sense, they can crash, we're heading rapidly in the direction where it will be very difficult to crash them, and that will be a good thing.
The jet that sees the runway, this was an unusual piece. It sort of seemed like this was a no-brainer for me, but... talk about the jet that sees the runway, Joel Barker.
Well, I think it's old news if you think about it, looking at the runway with radar, because I flew to Belgium, this is 15 years ago, and as we were coming in, it was extremely foggy, and I was looking out the window waiting to see the runway, and I heard the wheels hit the runway, and you couldn't see it, and the pilot got on the air and said, oh, by the way, the automatic landing system landed us. So, you know, that if that's what they mean by seize the runway, it's been around a long time.
Right. That seemed like a kind of a no-brainer even in the year 2000.
Yep.
That would become more commonplace.
Yeah.
But that idea of these planes that can literally, from takeoff to landing, be entirely automatic, that hasn't happened yet, but, I mean not everywhere, but those systems do exist, don't they?
No, I think, there's only one psychological problem, which is if you got on a plane and they said, oh, by the way, the plane will be flying, it's not the pilot, I think some of us would get off the plane.
Right.
But they really do, you know, most of the stuff is automatic, but then every once in a while you need a wonderful old pilot, like the guy who landed in the Hudson River.
Right.
The plane never would have figured that one out.
Yeah, you would. Yeah, would figure that that would be the time when you need a Sully Sullenberger standing by to make sure that you can land that thing. The train that you're never late for. This was a prediction made back in the year 2000 that we would have by the year 2010. The train we're never late for. Explain that.
You know, I don't know where they were going because when you think about it logically, a train has to be on a specific schedule. Therefore, if you're late, you're late. It's not going to wait for you. So that was one of those I read and I thought, well, it's somebody who takes a train into New York every day and wants it to wait for him, evidently. It's not going to happen. At least it doesn't make sense to happen.
Right. And the idea is somehow that there would just be these kind of these rail systems that there would always be a train coming by. There would always be it almost sounded like the vacuum tubes, like you're going to a bank or something and you're sending something up through the tube to the teller.
Well, that has been a vision, and it's actually a Minnesota vision. A guy named Anderson, engineer at the University of Minnesota, proposed a single car train, but we've never seen it. You know, it doesn't exist. I've never seen it in prototype. It's an interesting idea, but certainly by 2010, we haven't seen it, and I don't see anybody talking about it for 2020 either.
No, and that's a market thing. Again, there has to be a need for it because it's going to cost a lot to build that kind of infrastructure.
Yep.
So everybody has to be on board. Okay, again, we're talking with futurist Joel Barker about predictions made in the year 2000 for 2010. Some are hits, some are misses, some are interesting. The mind that moves objects. Explain what we were supposed to be able to do by the year 2010.
Well, we were supposed to have figured out how to physically move things in the real world by thinking about it. I haven't seen anything doing, I have seen nowhere where we're doing that, but we are doing something that may be actually more important than that, is we are starting to set up situations where you can think about something and move a virtual object in the computer world, in the digital world. And you could argue, in fact, we'll talk about this in my discussion for 2020, you could argue that that interaction is at least as important as a physical interaction.
Well, and so in a way, actually, we have that, because I don't know, that's not a hit or a miss to me. The idea of the mind that moves objects, that taps right into the jets that are being flown by brainwave impulse, right? I mean, so it's moving, it is flying the jet, it is moving an object. It's just we're not walking around like we're in Bewitched, where we can we can move something across a room. If you haven't gotten to that.
You accept the digital interface,
right,
then we've got it.
Yeah. The mind that moves objects, that's computer enhanced and electronically enhanced, we can do that.
Yep.
So maybe, you know, maybe that's something for still that we can put on the table, that someday we might be able to do that on our own. But we're a long way from those big giant brained people in Star Trek with the big throbbing, you know, veins on the side of their forehead, where we could see them thinking and objects would move, or people would become handcuffed or frozen or something. All right. So but that still interesting. Right now we go to the mall where every price is negotiable. Hit.
I think it's eBay.
Yeah.
I think we've got it. I think, and it, of course, it wasn't exactly the way they pictured it in the article, but that's really important to say. Everything that we talk about doesn't come across, you know, literally word for word what we describe it, but in terms of the function, eBay is the negotiable mall.
Yeah.
You know, we got bids on everything. Everything's an auction.
Right.
You couldn't have a more negotiable situation than on eBay, and it is an enormous market.
It's sort of the e-bazaar, where you can haggle over everything on eBay, on many other websites, too, where they're doing, you know, these sort of massive quantities of things. You know, they have closeout prices like The O and other places, where you can get things for much lower than even they want to sell it to you. If suddenly the demand drops, they'll drop the price, and they'll move this stuff one way or another. And that would fall into the category, at least cyber malls, where the cyber mall where every price is negotiable.
Yep. So we've got that one.
Okay. We don't have the weatherman who is always right.
We sure don't.
Okay. Explain that.
It's the weather is highly complex, chaotic, and teeny little things can make big alterations. You think about this huge frozen weather that came down into Florida last week. You just don't see that very often. But in a chaotic system, you will see it. It's
right.
Just it's not predictable. So the weather is, I think, is going to always be one of those things that maybe we can do 48 hours. Maybe we can do 72 hours. More than that, I don't think.
They quote Robert Gall, lead scientist for the U.S. Weather Research Program, who explains that once computers have the power and speed up to several teraflops, they'll then be able to create virtual models of the atmosphere on the scale at which a lot of weather conditions actually form. Not yet.
Not yet.
Not yet. So that could happen, but not yet. The weatherman who is always right, that would put actually a lot of weathermen out of business, too.
So
they're probably not cheering for it either. All right, that brings us up to the kitchen of tomorrow. This, again, is from an article back in the year 2000 in New York Times Magazine. Joel Barker and I talking about what we were supposed to have by the year 2010. And then Joel's predictions starting at the top of the hour as a futurist on what we will have by 2020. Coming up on Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. Well, a quick check of our wiki tells us that Huey Lewis of Back in Time fame will turn 60 this year. Doe! He wishes he could get back in time. And I never knew this, that Huey Lewis's, what is it? Huey Lewis's grandfather was the inventor of that red wax sealant that goes around cheese. Just hang on to that thought. Anytime you have that little red wax sealant around cheese, that's Huey Lewis's grandfather. Then that's an innovation. That was a progress it made for not just for a successful innovation for all of us for our eating pleasure, but also someday we would have great cheesy rock songs from Huey Lewis that I love. Don't get me wrong. Some great pop tunes from Huey Lewis in the news. And if you go online at coasttocoastam.com, you'll see the link for Joel Barker, who also takes a look into the future and back in time as we're going back to the year 2000 of the predictions that we had for 2010, seeing which ones are true, which ones were fails. Also, you can link up to my blog there if you want to see the picture that's kind of gross of the sheep with a human face on it. Yeesh. But it's a birth accident. It's kind of weird, or it's photoshopped, one of the two. Anyway, go take a look on my blog, click onto it there if you dare, and we'll get back to the future next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. All right, so back with Joel Barker, who has written many books and produced many successful videos. In fact, I was just looking at some of your Amazon information. Paradigms, the business of discovering the future, putting our differences to work, the fastest way to innovation, future edge. There's the book that you were on for the first time with me talking about, five regions of the future. Yep. Remember that? Yep, that was cool.
I do remember that.
Back in 2005, was it?
Yep, we had a good time.
I remember that very well. And then, of course, he wrote Books of Blood. Oh, no, wait, that's Clive Barker. Never mind.
Right.
Okay. You probably get that all the time. So, Joel Barker, we were going through the New York Times Magazine piece back in 2000 about things that we would have for sure in the year 2010. Here we are, and we don't have the scanner that will run your kitchen.
We don't, and there's a very simple reason for that. It added work. And the dumbest thing you can ever do to a woman or a man who is trying to keep the kitchen in place is to say, you're going to have to sit down and take everything and scan it through again so that this little computer can tell you, you need to buy this again, or you don't need to buy this again, or you have it in your refrigerator, or if you dig far enough, it's in the back of the cupboard. Asking people to do more work is not a smart thing to do with an innovation.
But they actually came up with it, the General Electric portable scanner that you would then point at every object in your kitchen and it would track, it would inventory, it would tell you what you need more. I mean, they came up with it. It's just nobody wants it.
That's right. Well, and remember, it doesn't do rutabagas.
Right, right. There's certain things it does do and certain things it won't. And what's the point?
And as organic as we are becoming, it was a losing proposition from the beginning.
The tongue with perfect taste.
Yeah.
Explain that. I don't even know what that means.
This is something that actually has been in an ongoing development phase, and I see it about every 18 months, a substantial improvement. It's an electronic tongue. The idea is that if you could have a capacity to sense as complexly as the natural tongue does, you could make judgments about food and about flavoring and all those sort of things without having a human being participate in it. What I've noticed that about every 18 months, this talks about hundreds of pockets. Well, you know, your tongue is millions of pockets.
Right.
So it's like saying, I've got something that's the start of something that could turn out to be a good idea. But the last time I saw it, they were in the thousands of pockets, and this is it's called microfluidics as a technology. They are really starting to get very, very teeny measures, picoliters of stuff that may get us to the point where an electronic device can say to us how good that glass of wine is going to be, rather than us to have to sample it. I think except for dangerous stuff, I'd rather do it myself.
Right. And I think that, again, there's the human design is so incredibly advanced on that that it's going to take a long time for technology to catch up.
Absolutely.
But not by the year 2010. The gun that won't kill anybody, that was a prediction back in the year 2000. That seems to be, you know, a hit, right?
Yeah.
We have guns that are, the non-lethal weapons industry has been booming.
Called tasers,
right.
Predominantly. American Technology Corporation, ATC, I think is their initials, are the guys who produce the gun, the sound gun that they're using in Iraq and Israel that makes people feel like their skin is heating up, so they step away from it very quickly. It's a artifact. Your skin isn't that isn't really what's happening, but it's causing that sensation to happen, and that's a gun that won't. I should qualify that. I suppose if you stayed in it long enough, it might kill you, but most people can step out of it.
Right.
So I think the non-lethal weapons industry, the rubber bullets and stuff like that, are proliferating, but the taser is, I think, the singular proof that somebody thought about we ought to slow people down without using bullets to do it.
Well, and there, so whether it's ultraviolet light, whether it's sound, there's lots of innovation on that.
Yeah.
The detective that every jury believes, this was a prediction made by New York Times back in the year 2000. I don't that was the idea of somehow a more reliable a witness or police witness.
Probably, but I really think it's CSI.
Yeah.
You know, what we know about eyewitnesses now is they're not very reliable. And so the concept of eyewitness is now going to be challenged more and more in court because there's very strong data that says people can really misread something. And so the real witness you want is the witness who is taking artifacts from the scene and other things and measuring them in such a way that says so-and-so's fingerprints were on this or you know, it's like we watch CSI Miami and CSI New York and these others
right.
do it.
Right.
What we know is there's a lot of fiction in that, but I think the science is heading that way.
I watched CSI Mankato. That's what I watched. The surveillance camera that picks out the bad guys. This was a prediction made back in 2000, but some people might call this a hit that we have this. I think this is a miss. I think this is one of those things that looked good on paper that we would have this by the year 2010, but we actually don't. I don't think this is very effective, and it's been proven to be unreliable. What about you on that?
I think we're heading that way. I think we're going to get it because facial recognition and computers, pattern recognizing is developing, really maturing in the computer technology field. And in particular, they're able to say, we're not looking at the face straight on, but even at an angle, starting to pick up certain measurements of brow and space, nose, size of lips, things like that. So I actually think by 2020 we will have it.
Okay, but then for the year 2010, I still put that down as a miss.
Yep, I would agree.
Right.
Yep.
Okay, and it still now requires human intelligence. You need to have human, as they call it, on the scene, I think, to make the best assessments of who's going to be the bad guy. And even there, it's imperfect. The suit that makes you feel as good as Prozac, as it was described in 2000.
Yeah.
That was goofy. That was the idea of somehow a suit that had electronic sensors that would react to changes in your body.
Yep.
Right? Kind of a mood suit.
Yeah, and release chemicals to adjust you, aromatherapy kinds of stuff. And can you imagine a person walking along and their smell changing and the, you know, 90 feet of walking because they got anxious about something?
Right.
You know, I think that was a scary one from the sense of, especially if you had the electronic noses out there, they'd get all confused, you know?
Yeah, suddenly you smell like pumpkin pie. It would be, I think it would stigmatize you. I think people would be looking at you.
Yep.
It would create more anxiety.
Yep.
And it would get worse.
You get the reputation as the cinnamon guy.
Exactly. In some neighborhoods, that might work for you. But the day trader that puts your mind at ease.
Oh, ho, 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 ho.
Okay, this is really, first of all, explain what this prediction meant.
Well, the guy was, if you read the article, it's actually a two-part article. One is he says, we're going to develop a computer program using deterministic programs and irrational and intuitive programs to do this. And then second, he keeps saying, but you know, human nature being what it is, if the program really worked well, then the stock market would come to a halt because everybody would know exactly the right thing to do. So by the time you finish his little article, you're saying, why would you ever even think about doing that? Because the market would fall apart. The very thing that you're trying to do, it destroys. So it's what we know is some very smart mathematicians tried to do that, and we're in the pickle we're in right now economically because of how bad their math worked.
All right, I mean, we're in a bit of a pickle, too, in the sense that I want to get to all of these predictions from the year 2000 for what we would have with us in 2010, but we better move along. So I'm going to read through some of these. You just jump in where,
okay,
where you want to, okay? Yep. The code that cannot be broken. This technology that says here that will cashier the linguists, mathematicians, and hackers who have been traditionally devoted themselves to breaking codes comes with the cool name quantum cryptography. Yeah, yeah. We have it, don't we? I mean, we're getting to this point?
We kind of have it. We have it, yeah. Enough so that we're developing pretty difficult codes, but right on its tail is the quantum computer, of course, which will be able to solve that problem.
Be able to decode it as,
yeah,
fast as we can do it.
Right,
the only book you'll ever need to read, that's Kindle,
that's
pretty much.
Kindle. Congratulations to Amazon. They figured it out, and I've got one, and I love it.
The only book you'll ever need to read, that's where you just download the books into one single book. The document that cannot be forged. This was interesting. This is the idea of somehow being able to come up with a fiber, unique patterns of fibers,
yep,
and that would create a document which then, well, through using other types of technology, you would know for sure was, you know, was from the source, not from somebody who was copying it.
Right. So it's just using the randomness of the paper fibers. But, you know, I haven't seen much of it. I haven't seen anything in my reading that says anybody's doing this. So,
but that was the prediction. So it's not a hit or a miss. I guess it's a miss. It's not here.
Yeah, they're not.
But
not commercialized.
Not commercialized. The genetic report card that will tell you if your embryo will get prostate cancer.
Not yet, but boy, they're moving on it.
This was by the year 2010. They said, yeah, here, geneticists say they'll be able to predict babies' propensities for many of the diseases that we dread most: breast, colon, and prostate cancer, heart disease, diabetes.
Yeah.
A DNA chip will be involved here.
Not yet, but it's, yeah, coming. By the way, there's a rule Arthur C. Clarke once had that we're watching right now, which is engineers are short-term optimists, long-term pessimists. And that's what we're seeing. We'll probably see that chip by 2015.
By 2015, you think we'll be able, yeah, to make those kind of predictions on babies' futures?
Yep. Yep.
Interesting. The bathroom that can give yourself a daily brain scan.
Well, we do in Japan. They have one that gives you a lot of other scans. I don't think it's scanning your brain, but it's doing a lot of chemical testing for you, and that the Japanese have got thrones that do that very nicely.
And this it reads your waists, and then it says too much sugar, too much salt, your blood pressure is too high. What I mean, I tell you what.
Yep.
All those things.
All that and more even.
So that's a hit. That,
yeah,
happened.
I would say the Japanese are doing it.
The severed limb that regrows itself.
I haven't seen it.
Yeah.
I haven't seen it. We're moving toward it, but I haven't seen it yet.
It says here, in the future, as of today, a newt will lose a power struggle with a predator. A lizard, say. The lizard will make off with a newt leg, but the rest of the newt will stay behind. There's a bit of blood, but belly to the ground, the newt will retreat to a damp spot under a rock. Several weeks will pass, during which the newt will make its living barely hindered by an incrementally growing stump. In 6 weeks, the lizard conflict will be nothing but a bad memory. The newt will be walking and swimming with a new limb, indistinguishable from the original. In the future, by the year 2010, human beings will be able to do the same.
Ain't doing
no.
No.
But it's cool.
It is cool, and we're moving toward it. The stem,
right,
cell research is taking us in that direction.
The coach who will put you in the zone. Do we even talk about this? This is about getting athletes to perform at their optimum, right?
Yeah. And, you know, I thought that's what they always did.
Right.
So, you know, you look at this, I suppose it's because they're going to do more technological reading and stuff like that. And we certainly see that in the Olympics. Probably not to the level we're talking about, you know, running in your EEG pattern.
Right.
I don't know if they're doing that now.
MRIs, CAT scans, all these things that they're doing to get somebody in their zone. They might have that. I mean, there may be, I haven't heard about it. The watch that is your lifeline to the world. You like this one.
I did, because it's not called the watch, it's called the smartphone. And that's really, you know, my son doesn't wear a watch. He looks at his cell phone for his time. But then it does all these other things and more. And when you read their description, if you scratch out watch, write in cell phone, everything else, you know, just follows beautifully from that.
Yeah, I mean, the original prediction was it would be a wristwatch with internet access and a cell phone.
Yeah.
It's really the other way around.
Yeah.
It's a cell phone with internet access, and that's also a watch.
It's a watch, yeah.
Yeah.
And by the way, that's an example of this watch thing isn't working, but we'd still like to have all the functions. We'll do it with the phone.
Yeah. Could someday they all be a watch? You put it on your and do like the Dick Tracy thing and talk to your wrist and say, computer, you know, find me a place to eat or something like that, and that would be on your wrist?
Just for the fun of it, try talking to your wrist and see how uncomfortable it is.
No,
I don't think it's ever going to make it.
The phone that puts New York in Montana, this was a prediction back in 2000 for the year 2010.
Yep.
Explain that one.
This is the idea of a large visual picture of someone you're talking to, so lifelike and so clear that you feel like you're talking to them. And Cisco has that. Cisco Systems has a communication system, video system, that when people sit across from you at the other side of the table, it's really a TV screen, and it is impressive. So we are there right now in probably going to be adding 3D probably in the next 5 years.
Adding 3D to the phone?
Sure, why not?
Okay, why?
More authenticity, you know, the sense of depth of the people sitting across on the other side just makes it a richer experience.
You know what? I'll give you an example. I was emailing back and forth with my friend Wendy, and we're supposed to get together at Cupcake at coming up later on this week, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so we're just going to have a cup of coffee, talk about some plans. And I said, well, you know, email me back and let me know that date is good for you still. And she wrote back. She said, I'll verify with Nomadic and get back to you. She's very technologically savvy.
Yeah.
I think, just why not verify with a phone call? Why do you Nomadic? Call me. I don't know.
When we get to the digital reality discussion for 2020, I'll tell you a story about my granddaughter.
Okay, well, good. Well, we'll get to that because we're almost done.
All right.
With the predictions from the year 2000 for where we were going to be in 2010. And then Joel Barker will make his predictions coming up as to where we will be in the year 2020, what you can expect coming up on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett.